Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Comic books were booming in the 40s and 50s. These weren't just simple tales of noble superheroes. Many were dark and grisly, some even downright shocking. People were outraged. The Senate investigated and the rules tightened. Goodbye, Tales from the Crypt. Hello, Casper the Friendly Ghost. This hour on Point, the 1950s comic book scare and how it changed America. Joining me now from New York City is David Haidu. He is music critic for The New Republic and a professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. His new book is The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. The New York Times calls it, quote, an amazing story with thrills and chills more extreme than the workings of a comic book's imagination. David, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So set the table for our conversation and tell us how comic books came about.
Sure. In the early 1930s, mid-1930s, a group of people who were outsiders of various sorts, social misfits, members of minority groups, Jews, Italians, women, Asian Americans, African Americans, had trouble fitting into conventional modes of expression in magazines and advertising agencies and gravitated toward the world of comic books because they felt that they were more welcome there than anywhere else. And once they got there, they expressed this pride in their outsider status and had free rein to do whatever they want. And what they did was pretty crazy at first, and then it got crazier and crazier and crazier until people took notice and said, oh, no, no more of this. That's the gist of it.
Well, so to back up a bit, so then by the mid-1940s, comics had really become an industry with tremendous influence. You really can't underestimate the popularity of these things. Tell us how many comic books were sold every week on average in this country?
Oh, it's hard to believe because I have three kids now, and I read comics when I was a kid, and my kids read comics now, and we think of comics as something for fans and enthusiasts, and it's kind of a clubby world for people who kind of trade, and they go off and they do their thing.
Yeah.
But comics in the late 1940s and 50s were the most popular form of entertainment in America. They somewhere between 60 and 100 million copies were sold every week.
Every week.
Now, that's more. That means more eyeballs are seeing comics than are seeing movies. Of course, movies were in decline then. Then we're seeing television. Television was in ascent, but not yet the national phenomenon. Radio was still popular, but comic books were more popular than radio. They were more popular than regular magazines and more popular than books. And everybody read them.
And you said it was kids, and the average issue was what passed along to six, eight, ten readers.
Right. I don't have a calculator, but and I'm not. It's words are my thing. I can't do math, but figure out six to ten readers passed around these 60 to 100 million copies each week. That means comics are getting to an awful lot of people, and they're not just keeping them in sealed envelopes and stashing them away in vaults so they could accrue value over the time. They're soaking them in, taking them in, loving them, and trading them amongst each other. But adults really weren't paying that much attention. In fact, nobody was paying attention. Can I tell you a little story?
Yeah.
One of the people, I interviewed about 150 comic book artists for my book over the course of 7 years, I guess. And one of them was an artist named Irwin Hasen. Now, most people today might remember him from doing Dandy, the newspaper strip, but he did comic books in the 1940s. So he was working for a comic book packager, and at the end of the day, he handed in his work. The packager came over to him and said, "That's a great story, kid. I'm going to play that up big," very enthusiastic. And Irwin told me that he realized after he had handed in the work that he had accidentally handed in only the top page of the work, and all the pages underneath were blank. He said. And his boss didn't even realize. I mean, he would have shipped them to the printer. They would have gone to print. Nobody was really paying any attention except kids.
You spoke about comics reaching people who felt sort of out of place. And in the book, you write at the turn of the century that the mission of the funny pages was to convoke the lower class, lower classes. What was the climate during that time that made comic books so relevant?
That's a good question. And the book starts with some deep history to put comic books in perspective, to show that they were part of a lineage of cultural conflict, a conflict between artists who had something wild to express to and the overseers of the status quo. And the and comic books were not the comic books came under fire, but they weren't the first form like this to come under fire. Comic strips, and there's a difference, newspaper comics in the early part of this century came under assault. When the first color newspapers, Sunday supplements, were published in the turn of the last century, the Yellow Kid, the Cats and Jammer Kids, and Crazy Cat, and all the early color comics, people considered them appalling. They were, one, because they were published on Sunday, and they threatened the sanctity of the Christian Sabbath. And two, and this is really the larger issue, because they were wild and in most cases, the most popular strips communicated a kind of cynicism and skepticism toward, a contempt actually, toward authority, a contempt toward authority. So they were full of kids, and mostly ethnic kids, little German kids, little Italian kids, little African American kids, immigrants, outsiders, strangers in a strange land, assaulting the authority figures, whether those authority figures were parents or the local cops or the school teacher. Whoever was in charge was an idiot, held in suspicion, and attacked.
Well, so when did the cynicism and this contempt, as you speak it, toward authority, when did that turn violent? When and why did comic books then turn so violent? And what did that say about America at the time?
Good. The lineage is that newspaper strips began to have a little bit of this sensibility, but comic books really took it on and took it further than newspaper strips ever did. And that's what you're talking about now. How comic books went much farther. In the late 1940s and late 1950s, comic books shifted away from superhero stories. I mean, some superheroes still existed. Batman was still published. Superman was still published. But most heroes went for this period of about 10 years receded in popularity or were discontinued. And in their place emerged a whole different genre of comics that are the ones that became the most popular form of entertainment in the country. And they were dark and lurid, focused on crime and vice and horror. Subtitles like Crime Does Not Pay, but with crime was the huge word on the cover, and Does Not Pay was a little bitty type underneath it. Comic books focused on gruesome depictions of horror with titles like Hate. Hate was a comic book title. And there would be, it was an image on the cover of a skull being blown apart and the brain splattering out of the out of the skull onto the pages. And I interviewed the publisher of those comics, a gentleman named Stanley P. Morse, who's still alive, and he was publishing those comics 60 years ago. And to this day, he isn't really very aware of what he published and doesn't really care.
Well, give us a tease, David, into our next segment where we're going to talk. Where we're going to talk about the comic book inquisition, if you will. But you say in the book that the censorship debate over comic books was really a prelude to sort of cultural battle over rock and roll. That it was really not music that that precipitated the Teen Rebellion. It was comic books.
That's right. in these stories of crime and vice, and also in romance comics, the creators of comic books who consider themselves outsiders of all sorts wrote and depicted all sorts of coded challenges to the prevailing culture, to the status quo. They had and there was a cynicism toward authority, a skepticism, a snarky humor, a kind of reveling in bad behavior of all sorts of naughtiness, and which was then considered juvenile delinquency. And the generation of young people who were reading this took on this ethic and this aesthetic, and it's the same kind of thing that we think of as starting with rock and roll, but it really didn't start with rock and roll. It started with these comics several years before rock and roll. So it's like everything we think of is Elvis and his hips and how daring it was to do, you know, to do this, you know, raw music and speak to young people. Is true, and that did happen. It's not a single source for popular culture of the 20th century, but it all started earlier.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the great comic book scare of the 1950s. Joining me from New York City is David Haidu. He's a critic for The New Republic and a professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. His new book is The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. All right, David, so tell us a little bit about the crusade against comic books, and in particular this one, Dr. Frederick Wortham.
Well, Wortham came to this crusade a little late. He didn't start it. It was a multi-pronged assault. It was an all-encompassing assault that started, well, it started with church groups. From church groups, women's groups took it on, the PTA and such, and other social groups and communities all around the country, the American Legion, and then municipal governments took action, and then state governments.
And what were they all concerned about? Just juvenile delinquency? Is that what it was?
Yeah, kids seemed to be changing, and they were. Young people, there was a cultural revolution in acting, and young people were taking on a different sensibility than their parents had. And the culture called it juvenile delinquency. Just, you know, kids seemed to be running wild, mainly because they had different sets of values and subscribed to different aesthetic values, had different tastes than their parents. And this was intolerable. And what happened was, this was a shock to me to discover this when I was doing my research. There were over 100 pieces of legislation, laws, introduced or passed all around the country on the city, the municipal level, and the state level that made comic books illegal. Various kinds of comic books illegal, or depictions of certain acts in comic books, including crime and romance and horror, made them either illegal or restricted their sale to minors all around the country. There was a period when crime comics were illegal in the county of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And a comic book vendor was arrested for selling crime comics. They were illegal for a while in the state of New York. Mm-hmm. They were legal in the state of Massachusetts. And not only that, but community groups organized bonfires where kids were led around neighborhoods and collected thousands of comics and campaigns that took days and weeks, and they would amass vast bonfires behind on their school grounds and other locations, and burn these comics as early as 1945. Just a few years after there were book burnings on the other side of the ocean, there were book burnings here, and kids were led in marches around these bonfires and induced to recite incantations and to vow to never read comic books again. It was absolutely horrifying. And not just a singular event, like led by some crazies in one community somewhere. There were dozens of them all around the country. And I went to some of the locations for the research of my book. I went to one in Binghamton, New York. I went to one in West Virginia, one in Wisconsin. I found some of the kids who took part in these events, and I interviewed the kids. And their stories and their narratives are in the book, and it's really, they're really quite harrowing.
Fast forward a few years to April 1954, mm-hmm. with these extraordinary congressional hearings at a U.S. courthouse in New York City. We go from bonfires to the Inquisition here. Tell us what happened in a televised event.
Mm-hmm. Well, as if state laws and municipal laws weren't enough, the federal government decided that it should consider taking action. And a congressional conducted hearings on the demon comic books, on the plight of the comic books. One of the committee members, but not the chair, was Senator Estes Kefauver. Now, this is a significant thing. Now, for this is a little involved, so bear with me for half a minute here.
Yeah.
A couple of years earlier, Kefauver had led a set of congressional hearings on organized crime, and they were broadcast nationally. In fact, they were the first hearings of their kind to be broadcast nationally. And America had never seen anything like this on television before. Here are actual real criminals talking about things that they never heard about in their living rooms before or never heard about in polite society before. Prostitution, crime, murder, all sorts of horrors. In their living room, in these hearings conducted by Senator Estes Kefauver, they were a phenomenon and they riveted the country. A couple of years later, in the same courtroom, okay, in the same place, mm-hmm. with Kefauver present, is another set of hearings that look an awful lot like those other hearings about crime. And the issues, the topics are almost the same. They're talking about crime again. They're talking about vice. They're talking about prostitution, but now on the pages of comic books. What happened in America, in the public consciousness, these two events got a bit confused, or by association, comic books were considered, the plight of comic books, what was thought to be and treated in the press and by the public as if it was everybody's grave, as these real crimes that had been taking place and that were the subject of hearings just a couple of years earlier.
And so, what was the result in the comic book industry?
Well, there were very few advocates for the comics, and one publisher, Bill Gaines, who published this, ran a company called EC, which ran the best and most serious and most ambitious of the crime and horror and suspense comics, volunteered to testify because he was so convinced that his comics were artful and had value. And he was so convinced that if he just had an opportunity to state his case, that he would be redeemed. So he volunteered to testify, and exactly the opposite happened.
Disastrous testimony.
Oh,
yeah.
He stayed up. He was fretting over this all night, and he stayed up, and he couldn't stay up. And he was a little heavy, and he was taking diet pills. He was taking Dexedrine to help him diet, and it found that it helped him stay awake when he was writing this testimony. And by the next day, he was a zombie, and he could barely stay awake during the testimony, and he got confused. I'm not defending pill popping, or I'm not trying to defend him, but this is what happened. He had a Dexedrine crash while he's on the stand, and Kefauver holds up the cover of Crime Suspense Comics, and on that cover is a murderer holding a head that had been severed from the body, that had been chopped off a body, and it's an attractive blonde woman, and this killer is holding this head by the hair, and there's blood dripping from her neck. And Kefauver says, "How can you defend this?" And Gaines says in effect, "Well, I defend this on the grounds of taste." And he said, "Taste?" Kefauver says, "How could this be in good taste?" And he said, "Well, it's in good taste for a horror comic." Kefauver says, "Well, what would be bad taste?" He said, "Well, if there was more blood gushing from the neck, that would be in bad taste." And that was it. The next day, front page of New York Times is crime comics publisher defending comics on the grounds of taste.
Hmm. And polls show after that, what, 70% of Americans after that believed comic books somehow were causing some sort of juvenile crime.
Mm-hmm. The tide of public opinion and the whole culture turned against comics. Gaines was driven out of business. Dozens of publishing companies were given out of business. Hundreds of comics were discontinued, and it's utterly a parallel to the Red Scare in Hollywood. And we all know the story of how screenwriters and actors were driven out of work by the Red Scare. We all know this. We've read, you know, countless books about this, seen movies about this. But this story is largely unknown to the public. Mm-hmm. And I did research and tried to find what were the actual effects of this? Was this a couple people who, they didn't get work in comics anymore? How do I quantify this? How dramatic was this event, this set of events, really? I found over 800 people, 800 people who were artists and comics and others working in comics who were never published in comics again. Now, not all of them were driven out of business, but a great, great many of those, hundreds among them were, and they were never published in comics again. And I went and found quite a few of them and interviewed them, and they were still bitter 50, 60 years later.
All these years later. Let's go to the phones, because I want to bring Harold into the conversation at this point. He's in Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
This is something that is so very close to my heart. I'm 71. And I had the complete run of The Haunt of Fear, Tales from the Crypt, and The Vault of Horror.
You had them.
Bill Gaines and EC and all of that series were absolutely wonderful. The artwork was phenomenal. Shock suspense stories, crime suspense stories, war against crime, the military series, science fiction. Everything was so fantastic. And I remember watching the McCarthy hearings as a kid. My father would watch them. And I, at that time, was not politicized. But now that I have grown up over the years and looked at a lot of the situations that have been in our country, it goes hand in hand with this banning of the comics.
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
If you had told your parents or an adult in those days, you'd see these comics I'm reading, these Harvey Kurtzman's war comics, which are so good. If they were published today, they'd win Pulitzer Prizes, because now comics are held in esteem, and they were. What would have happened if you had said, "Oh, this is really good"?
Well, you know the funny part about it, when I outgrew my taste for comic books, which I'm so sad that I sold them to another younger kid. But my mother knew that I read these comics, and she just assumed it was comics. She didn't look at them. She didn't examine them. But she was an indulgent mother, because I was an only child. So she would have said, well, if you like it, it's okay. But I was a very, I was a calm, kind guy. I wasn't a violent guy. It didn't make me become violent. Mm-hmm. But I was in love with the artwork of Ghastly Graham Ingalls and Jack Davis and Harvey Kurtzman. And do you know that subsequently all of those EC series have been republished in hardback covers with slipcases for hundreds of dollars? And to have the originals today from the comic book stores, you would pay thousands of dollars for some of them that are 10-cent comic books if they're in pristine condition.
Wow.
And
Harold,
the art of comic is definitely a part of our American culture, extremely creative. And I remember poor Bill Gaines, and I remember when they pulled the comics, why can't I get that next issue? Well, we're not getting them from the distributor. And I'll tell you, this is a great, great little play this morning. And
well, thank you so much for your call, Harold. I really appreciate it. Such great perspective, David. You hear in his voice, he was there, he remembers, yeah.
Jane, can I add a point?
Yes, please.
Can I have time? Because this is not in the book, because this is an event that took place a little after the book ends. But when Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins were initially planning West Side Story, Sondheim came into an early meeting with a conception for the opening scene. And the conception was that the Jets would be in the Doc's malt shop, and they would all be reading comic books. And Sondheim said in this meeting that this would be shorthand to show that they were juvenile delinquents. Mm-hmm. This would be a way of showing that they were all, all questionable kids from the wrong side of the tracks. All they need to do is be reading comic books. And he had an idea that the original musical number would be a debate and conversation about a song about comics among the Jets. And then Jerome Robbins said, that's a good idea, but, I think I'll do it in dance, which is what he did. But that was considered shorthand for juvenile delinquency.
Interesting.
Then.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. You say in the book, David, that the real-life ramifications of those Senate hearings were a Comics Magazine Association of America that imposed a code of standards, if you will, and you called it an unprecedented and never surpassed monument of self-imposed repression and prudery. Mm-hmm. 5 full-time censors to look at comic books. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, most comic titles were actually put out of business.
That's right. The comics industry was desperate to find some sort of way to survive this attack, this onslaught. So it created a code based on the Hays Office code that regulated the movies. But instead of serving as a survival mechanism, it turned out to be a noose. And, mm-hmm. they essentially enacted their own demise. It was Harry Carey, because they had the code gelded the comics. It robbed the comics of its essence. No longer could comics challenge authority, and that was a specific stipulation of the code that all comics needed to show respect for authority. So disrespect for authority was now banned.
I want to take one more call before we go to break here. Richard is calling from Brookhaven, New York. Richard, welcome to On Point. Hi.
Oh, hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I wanted to make 2 points. I grew up in New York City in the late 40s, and I'm hearing negative comments about comic books. There are educational aspects of it. When I was a very small kid, maybe 3, 4 at the most, I had cousins who would bring comic books when they came to visit us, and I discovered I could read, quotation marks, the stories by looking at the pictures. Uh-huh. One time I was reading a story and turned the page, and the story just ended abruptly, and I didn't understand what was going on. And my cousin said to me, you see that balloon over the character's head? Those letters in there are words. And at the end of the page, it says, to be continued in the next issue. Uh-huh. At that point, I decided I'm going to have to learn what the letters mean. And by age 4, I suspect I was reading.
Taught you to read?
So that was a very positive aspect.
Next point, really quick. I got to go to break. Richard, go ahead.
Okay, the other thing was there was something called classic comics. All of the Dumas stories, things of that sort, were in comic book form. Kids who had to do book reports used those well before Cliff Notes came out. So I think that's another positive aspect. Mm-hmm. One might have used them to fight the people who were saying comic books were a bad influence on the young people.
Richard, thank you. Quick comment, David, before we go to break?
No, good points. Yeah. Those classic comics, though, were awfully gruesome.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the comic book scare of the 1950s. From New York City, I'm joined by David Haydu. He's a professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism and author of the fabulous new book, The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. I'd like now to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining me from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Tony Davis. He's owner of The Million Year Picnic, a comic book store in Harvard Square. The store has been there around there since 1974, and Tony's worked there since 1983. Tony, welcome. Good to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And David, we just got your book in today. It looks fascinating. I can't wait to read it.
Good time.
Tony, I have to tell you, it's a thrill to have my book sold in your store, because I don't want to tell my wife how many how much I've spent in your store. So maybe I'll get some of it back. Well, I spent a lot of time in Cambridge researching my second book, and I would go in there every trip. So thanks for all the good reads.
Well, thank you.
Quite a connection. Well, you've been listening to the conversation, Tony. I wonder if, after you've heard everything David said, if the 1950s comic book scare affects your store today. Can you draw some sort of direct link in any way?
Well, it certainly does. I think the 1950s scare did to the comic industry what Prohibition did to the American wine industry. It really disrupted the creative development of the medium for decades. And I think at the time that I first came to the Million Year Picnic in 1983, we're just starting to pull out of the... It had sort of bottomed out. I think there were basically two types of comics that you could find. Mainstream superhero comics from Marvel Comics and DC Comics. So Batman, Spider-Man, the X-Men. Mm-hmm. And kids' comics. And even from the point where I started buying comics in the early 70s to 1983... Children's comics had gone from Archie, Richie Rich, Casper, Disney, to basically only Archie was left. Mm. So there wasn't a lot coming out. And, you know, I remember back in the 80s on New Comic Day, we'd get mountains of boxes, but within those mountains of boxes, there were most 20, 25 titles. Mm. And they were pretty much all superhero books. And today, I think, you know, we've been in sort of a 20, 25-year period of rebirth and renewal. So today I go through a monthly catalog that has about 500 pages of comics, comic-related magazines and books. And on New Comic Day, instead of getting 20 titles, we get 100 titles. Mm. And there's a lot more diversity, a lot more volume. But what has really changed is the sort of the place the comic books have within the American culture. Mm. We've become, I think, much more of a fringe medium. So the readership is vastly decreased.
What's the typical customer for you, Tony? How old are these kids? Are these teenagers? Are these older folks? Who is it?
It's changed a great deal. When I started working here in the 80s, we had lots of young boys, 10, 12, 14 years old, college kids, and then we had adults who had grown up reading superhero comics and continued to collect them. And we're very much graying now. I think most of my customers are 25 or older. Mm-hmm. I certainly have a lot of customers in their 40s and 50s and 60s. And if we see young kids now, it's mostly young girls who are attracted by Japanese manga. Hmm. So there isn't as much for the young readers. And I think what superheroes represented to young boys, it's been replaced by video games and by things they can do on the computer.
Interesting. David, go ahead.
I have three kids, two boys, a girl in between. But the two boys, one is almost 5 and one is almost 25. The 5-year-old doesn't read comics, but the 25-year-old goes out to New Comics Day every week and comes back with a pile of comics.
Exactly.
Tony, what do you think? Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Because my area of study was the 1940s and 50s when comics were at the center of the culture and, as I was saying earlier, the most popular form of entertainment in America. What's different today? Why do you think they're more, as you described, a fringe medium today? What's different, do you think?
Well, I do think that for the most part, half the readership was driven away. Female, there was really nothing for young girls besides Archie. Mm-hmm. And I think you've sort of seen tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young girls and women drawn in by manga because there are so many manga titles that are by women and speak to women. Mm. And as far as young boys, you know, even now, as we've seen sort of the genre comics come back, war, horror, mystery, particularly fantasy and some science fiction, it's all aimed at an older audience. These are, you know, intelligently written tales by the Alan Moores, the Neil Gaimans, and they aren't direct, I think they're directed at a more sophisticated audience than sort of the most lurid of the 1950s horror magazines.
You know, people are inclined to make parallels between comics and music, and I can't help but see a parallel between jazz and comics, because there was a time when jazz was the most popular music in the country in the swing era, and then jazz evolved and it morphed into bebop, and that became something for an elite, smaller group of connoisseurs. And maybe there's something parallel going on now, where comic books are kind of are sophisticated and complex, but speak, but are an object of connoisseurship and speak to a kind of an elite. Well, Tony, does that make sense?
It does, and I meet a lot of young kids who want to do comics, who want to create comics, and actually there are programs. There's the School of Visual Art in New York. There's the Comics Center up in Vermont that are teaching kids how to do comics, everything from writing and drawing and narrative storytelling to how to silkscreen a cover. So I still see a lot of interest in teens and 20-somethings in creating comics. But I do think as, you know, sort of an escapist medium or even, you know, just a medium that draws kids in, somehow we've lost that audience. And I don't particularly know how we get it back. I know part of it is putting comics in libraries. Part of it is putting comics in schools. Part of it is parents, you know, reaching out to their kids and saying, I want you to read, and I want you to read everything from books and magazines to comics. Because my mom was a school teacher in our house. Anything that involved reading was a positive.
Tony and David, hold on. I want to bring another caller into our conversation here. Walter is on the line now from Lexington, Massachusetts. Walter, welcome. Hi.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, good.
I wanted to thank the author very much for writing the book, because now I finally understand why my parents burned all my comic books.
All these years later.
Now you know why they're worth so much money. Yeah. They were all burned.
Well, what I did was, after I came into some money, I went and replaced all of them. And what I had was all war comics from the 50s and all the Frontline Combats and the Two-Fisted Tales from the EC line. And I bought them all again.
You got the last laugh. Walter, thank you. Mike now is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane, David. I grew up with comics in the Comic Code Authority era, 70s, my shameful secret is that I still occasionally read comics, but now I'm a parent who spends a lot of time configuring filters on my kid's computer to filter out the pervasive pornography. Censorship here in the program so far has been referred to in derogatory terms, but you know, concerned parents in the 50s and concerned parents now do have, you know, legitimate concerns about what their kids are getting. And you say that adults didn't know what was going on with comics in the 50s. They know even less now, because you don't have the comic book rack in the drugstore. It's all these the comic book store, specialized stores where they're sold, and sometimes by subscription. And, you know, a comic book store in Cambridge, I submit, is going to be a little different than a comic book store, say, in Columbus, Ohio. I think that the industry is still targeting mostly young readers. And when you say it's the themes and stories are more adult, you betcha. There's a lot of, you know, soft porn, violence, killing. There's concern. There's now with this renaissance you're referring to, there's renewed concern, I think, from concerned parents about what's being targeted at our kids. And I'd like to hear some discussion about how the experience in the 50s should be informing the industry about this.
Terrific question, well, Mike. Thank you. David?
I'd say I could not agree more. And even though my book is a work of history and it's set in the 1950s, it's essentially about the struggle that parents are confronting right now, and I'm confronting with my nearly 5-year-old right now. And as much as my book is a war story and it's a battle between two sensibilities and two generations and two sets of institutions, two aesthetics, I tried to give due justice to each point of view. Because if you interview the combatants of any war, each set of people feels that they have something worth fighting for. And the parents, and even Frederick Wortham and many of the legislators and community groups who were troubled by comics weren't demons. They weren't all crazy. There was a kind of extremism in some of these comics. There were depictions of necrophilia. There was sadomasochism. And in those days, it was every bit as extreme as the Hostel movies today or the Hills Have Eyes movies today. And I find them deeply troubling.
David, you mentioned video games, and I wonder, does the debate over comics sound a lot like the contemporary arguments about video game violence that we hear so much?
It's the DNA for that argument, and I think video games grow out of the same conflict, but they're different, and I think this debate is unique in some ways, and that video games are participatory. You know, in reading, yes, the object, the reader relates to the protagonist, but they're not participatory in the same way. I mean, in Grand Theft Auto, the kid is doing the crimes. I think that's a significant difference, and I'm very troubled by this, and I also understand why parents and legislators were troubled by the comics in those days, and my book is not a black and white portrayal of these events. These issues are complicated, and there are warnings in those set of events and lessons for parents today in what happened 50, 60 years ago.
Tony Davis, with that in mind, what's your product line today look like? What's your best seller? What flies off the shelf?
Well, my product line, I think, is pretty diverse. Our best seller right now is actually Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where Joss Whedon is actually continuing the TV show in comic book form. And then the usual sort of suspects in terms of X-Men and Superman and Batman, but also some good genre comics in terms of Why the Last Man by Brian Vaughn, a book called Fables, and, you know, a lot of the better alternative comics, Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi, Chris Ware's Acme Novelty Library. I'd actually like to speak, though, to this last question, which is that, you know, the bulk of my customers are adults. And my worry is seeing comic books sort of ghettoized as a juvenile medium, when I think there are a number of their Pulitzer Prize-winning books out there. Mm-hmm. They're books that are speaking, I think, in very eloquent terms to wide readerships and to adult readerships. So my concern is that while I don't mind having limitations on what I can sell to a minor, I don't want the medium to be limited to what it can do creatively. I don't want the adults who come into my store to be cut off by censorship from reading the kind of comics they want to read by people who think that all comic books are for kids, or predominantly for kids, because I just don't think that's true anymore.
Tony Davis, I so appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tony Davis is owner of the Harvard Square comic book store, the Million Year Picnic. Appreciate your time. Back to the phones now. Jenny is calling from Gloucester, Virginia. Jenny, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Jean. How
hi.
Are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to go back to the point the other gentleman was making, who is trying to decipher all the things that his kids are looking at. And I'm a teacher, so I understand this. I also understand, in high school, kids have a lot of questions nowadays, and they're facing very different issues. And we also have a supply and demand economy, so these two things will kind of always be in conflict as far as trying to teach our kids realism and also at the same time teaching them how to put those things in perspective. And until we figure out what the cause of a warped mind is, I think that we will always be kind of concerned about what the kids are looking at, what age they are, what maturity, and you know, it's kind of I guess maybe one of the causes of the 1950s, and maybe your author can address this, is the kind of underground aspects to the comics at that time may have contributed to the overwhelming reaction. When he said, you know, somebody would bring comic books from another, you know, house into another household, and the parents really weren't aware. And so it's that kind of thing, just like with the computers today, the video games, which I agree with your former guests, they are very different.
Jenny, I'm gonna cut you off because we're running out of time. Thanks for your call. David, do you want to respond to that? There's some sort of underground element going on back then?
I think the reason that adults were so terrified of comics and considered them such a threat was not that they were underground. It was that they were so prominent, that there were dozens of comics in every newsstand, that they were all around. But for a long time, parents weren't aware of what was on the pages, and once they realized what was on those pages, they said, "Oh my God, you know, we have to deal with this. But it's really kind of the opposite of the being underground. Comics then went underground, and they've been somewhat underground ever since. Mm.
So for your next book, you're returning to music? Is that what I hear?
How do you know about that?
I have my sources.
Oh, yeah. I'm doing a biography of a jazz singer named Billy Eckstein. Very dramatic story. So I don't know if you have a calendar that goes 5 years ahead. Okay. So put an X on the day 5 years from now. I want to come back.
We'd love to have you. Great. Thanks, David Haidu, so much for your time. Such an interesting topic, and your book is fascinating, to say the least. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Haidu, professor at Columbia University and author of the new book, The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. To read an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.